train's already slowing down, and the engineer might get mad if I tell him it's a no-go. You know how much it costs to make an unscheduled stop on a train this big? Please, please, I promise, no more nudity. Roxanne sighed heavily and then said into her walkie-talkie, Okay, service boss here again. Let's cancel that. Repeat, cancel the 142. She stared at the young man, her expression that of a woman in complete control. Now look here, baby. I see one inch of something on you I shouldn't, then you going off this train. I don't care where we are, middle of the desert or highest mountain. No more reprieves. We understand each other? He nodded meekly and then pulled the blanket over his head. Night-night, Arizona, said Roxanne as she and Eleanor walked off. The two women went down to the lower level, where Roxanne inspected the choir's bathing operation. Satisfied with the progress, she and Eleanor headed to the lower lounge area and sat at an empty table. Boys' choir, anti-demon dust, and a naked man from Arizona? You've had a busy night. Oh, honey, this was actually pretty tame. The things I could tell you. I wish you would. Well, maybe we could spend some time together off the train. Eleanor was beginning to think that she could get Max to make Roxanne a paid consultant on the film project when the train started to slow down noticeably. Is there a problem? Asked Eleanor. No, this stretch of track has speed restrictions and a few gate crossings. Come with me, I'll show you a nice little benefit to train travel that you positively can't enjoy on a plane. Roxanne led Eleanor down to one of the train's vestibules, where she opened the upper window of the train door, allowing in a burst of refreshingly cold air. God, that feels wonderful, said Eleanor. I come down here a few times each day, just to clear my head, smell the air, get a close look at this land without an inch of glass or nothing else in the way. They watched the countryside pass by for a bit, and then Roxanne closed the window as the chief picked up speed. I got Regina to do this a couple of times a trip, too. Gives you some peace. Recharge your batteries. How many kids do you have besides Regina? 9, all grown, of course, and 23 grandchildren. She shook her head. You don't look nearly old enough. Well, I started really early, maybe too early. Roxanne shot Eleanor a glance. You have any kids? Eleanor shook her head. Never even been married. Now you want to tell me how a beautiful, smart, successful sort like yourself never landed a good man who loved her? Maybe I'm really not that beautiful, smart, or successful. Baby, take one look in the mirror, and I doubt you'd be working with a man like Max Powers if you weren't pretty well endowed in the brain and talent department. Well, it happens, you know. People do end up alone. All sorts of people. Yes, it does, and there's always a reason for it, too. Care to tell me yours? Eleanor looked away and fiddled with her fingers while Roxanne studied her closely. Wait a minute. Let me see if I can guess. You found you a good man who loved you, only it didn't work out. Maybe he never asked that all-important question that a woman desperately wants to answer yes to, and you finally went your separate ways, she added quietly, until you saw him again on this train. Eleanor glanced at her sharply, a suspicious look on her face. The way you and Tom Langdon act around each other, it's pretty clear. Plus, the train gossip grapevine is alive and well on the old chief. Eleanor's face flushed. Well, my goodness, if I'd only known how transparent I was, I can't tell you what a relief it is that so many people I don't even know are aware of my romantic history, or should I say fiasco. I'm not looking to pry, Eleanor, but I am a good listener. Eleanor finally took a deep breath and looked across at Roxanne. Tom Langdon is a wanderer, always has been, always will be. He craves adventure, he craves change, like other people need food. He's the sort who couldn't make a commitment if his life depended on it. And no, he never asked me to marry him. But I understand you haven't seen him in years. Maybe he's changed. Eleanor shook her head. Men like him don't change. He's back in the States traveling around and writing fluff instead of covering wars overseas, but that won't last. 6 months from now, he'll be off doing something else. I lived with him for years. I know how he thinks. She paused and added, And he has a girlfriend. He's going to see her in L.A. You think he's made a commitment to her?
I doubt it.
You mean you hope not?
Eleanor just looked away. Roxanne said,
Let your heart be your guide, girl. If you truly love him, I say give him another chance. It may be your only chance for happiness.
What if feelings have changed over time? What if you're not the same person you once were?
Eleanor, love is like a good piece of wood. It just gets stronger and stronger as the years go by. Take it from someone who had it and only lost it when the Lord decided it was time I shared Junior with him. It sounds corny, I know, but it's really the only thing that works between two people. The only thing.
Chapter 22. Kansas City was a major stop where many people got on and off, and the train lingered a while as it refueled and restocked. Roxanne escorted the woman heading to Denver by way of the California Zephyr to where she needed to go. Tom took the opportunity to step out for some fresh air before the bachelor party started. Recalling what Herrick Higgins had said, Tom watched as more pieces of America climbed aboard the train, no doubt flush with stories to tell, experiences to exchange, perhaps friendships, however short-lived, to form. The snow was falling hard, so he sought shelter under one of the overhangs. He glanced over in surprise as Eleanor climbed off the train and headed toward him.
Little stuffy on the train, she explained.
Yeah, me too.
They both stood there awkwardly until she said, I can't tell you what a shock it's been seeing you. I thought a million times about contacting you over the years, but I never did. Call it pride, stubbornness, stupidity. Take your pick. They're all there. Well, I guess with the way things ended, I can't blame you. He drew closer. Do you believe in second chances? She pulled back a bit. Tom, I can't take that hurt again. I can't. You left me, remember? After all those years of being together, it was time to put up or shut up, she said bluntly. I needed a commitment, and I didn't get it. I assumed your career took priority over everything else. People can change, Ellie.
So I've heard. Do you really think writing about antique furniture will last? And you have a girlfriend you're going to see for Christmas. Are you ready to commit to her? It's not that sort of relationship.
Of course not. You're not that sort of man. She shook her head and looked away. Tom gripped her shoulder and turned her toward him.
It's not that sort of relationship because I don't love her.
There's only one woman I've ever loved, Ellie. You know that.
Tom, don't do this to me, please.
So why did you come out here? It's freezing.
I don't know.
I don't believe that. I think you know exactly why.
Maybe I do. Nothing in my life has been as good as what we had. Nothing. I've been searching all these years for something.
I've been looking too, she said, and not finding it.
It can't just be a coincidence that we're both on this train. It's an omen, don't you see? It was meant to be.
You sound like Misty. Love doesn't work that way. It's not some magic fairy dust. It's something you work at every day.
As she flicked a strand of hair out of her face, and the full force of those emerald eyes fell on him, it might as well have been 10 years prior or a decade hence. It didn't really matter to Tom. In the wash of lamplight, the woman's gaze was as hypnotic and intoxicating a thing as Tom had ever experienced. He thought he was taking a step back, but he actually moved closer to her. He watched his hand slide another errant strand of auburn hair out of her face. Then his fingers moved to her cheek and gently rubbed it. She didn't move to stop him.
Well, maybe it's time I started to work at it.
He took a deep breath, glanced up for a second, and his lips parted, and his gaze held on the figure walking his way. He shook his head in disbelief, because this was the second shock that he'd received in a little over 24 hours. How many more thunderbolts could he survive? It was Lelia Gibson, striding toward the train, a caravan of redcaps in her wake, tugging along her prodigious baggage. The woman was incapable of traveling light.
It was one of her fortes, packing with indefatigable vigor each outfit planned for a particular segment of the journey, each accessory judged with an eye as critical as the ablest general plotting battle tactics. Tom took a step back from Eleanor, who'd closed her eyes, her lips searching for Tom's but not finding them. "Ellie?" She opened her eyes, slid a hand across his cheek as he took another step back. "What's wrong?" "Really quick, think of the worst bit of timing you've ever had in your life." "What?" she asked in a bewildered tone. He glanced once more at Lelia. She was closing in. He wasn't sure if she'd seen him yet, but it was only a matter of time. She obviously knew he was on this train. "The worst piece of timing in your life. Think of it right now, okay? Please?" "I actually think this is pretty bad timing on your part," she said in a very annoyed tone. "Just think of it." "Okay, okay. Have you thought of it?" She hesitated for a moment. "Yes, so?" He let out his breath. "So I just beat it. I just crushed it, in fact. I'm the undisputed king of bad timing." He pointed toward Lelia. "My sort of girlfriend in L.A.? That's her, Lelia Gibson." Eleanor swung around and stared at the approaching group. "Did you know she was boarding the train?" "No. That one qualifies in the total heart-stopping shock of a lifetime category." Eleanor folded her arms across her chest and moved away from Tom. It was then that Lelia saw Tom and waved frantically. As she barreled down on her target, Eleanor retreated even more until she was just a shadow in the darkness. As Tom watched her recede, it was as though all the blood in his body was going with her. He turned to face Lelia. He took a little solace in the fact that things certainly couldn't get any worse. Yet indeed, they could. Chapter 23. The National Weather Service issued advisories for the far Midwest and Southwest regions, citing the potential of a severe winter storm that was making its way south down the spine of the Rocky Mountains. The full fury of the tempest it would become was considerably masked by adjacent meteorological conditions in the Pacific Northwest, ameliorating safeguards that would fall away as the weather system moved through Wyoming and then into Colorado. About the time the storm suddenly unleashed all its might on the border between Colorado and New Mexico, it would be too late to issue any more warnings. All that would be left would be to read about the land squall of the decade in the newspapers and recount it to future generations in hushed tones. Herrick Higgins had taken advantage of the long stop in Kansas City to see the engineer. They'd discussed the weather reports coming in from Amtrak Central Dispatch. Though Higgins was no longer employed by the rail service, there was no one who worked passenger trains for a living who wouldn't welcome his wise input and counsel. He and the engineer were friends going back 20 years, and when Higgins told him he didn't like the way things were shaping up, particularly since they were heading into Colorado, the engineer took serious note. Higgins also told the man to pack on as much fuel as possible.
"We'll keep our eyes open," said the engineer. "As soon as we hear anything new from dispatch, I'll let you know."
Higgins went back and sat in the lounge car as the train finished taking on supplies and passengers. Over the course of his long career, he'd seen just about every possible equipment foible, personnel miscue, and weather mishap. He'd learned to go with his instincts in those circumstances. Instincts honed from over 30 years of doing the job. He didn't like the way the sky looked and the way the wind was blowing. He didn't like the sharp angle of the snowfall. He kept staring out the window at a sky that seemed to promise nothing except trouble.
"What are you doing here, Lelia? Is that all I get after traveling all this way to surprise you?" she said. "Do you know you can't get a direct flight from L.A. to Kansas City? I mean, what is that about? I had to fly through Denver. It was a nightmare. And all I get is, what are you doing here, Lelia?"
She gave him a hug and a kiss, and he felt extreme guilt, for they had a relationship after all. They were dating, sort of. They were going to Tahoe for Christmas. Rediscovering Eleanor had caused him to nearly forget all that.
"I'm sorry, it's just a shock seeing you. I thought you might have called it quits after the Eric episode."
"Don't be silly.
Why don't we get on the train and talk about it? I'll fill you in on everything. Everything? What everything?
Later, on the train, after I unpack.
She gave her ticket to one of the red caps and told him to get her bags on board. She tipped them generously with both money and a dazzling smile. She was dressed in classic Hollywood, meaning expensive and eye-catching. The poor Kansas City Red Cap Battalion would never be the same, Tom felt certain. They probably would have paid her just for the privilege of toting her matching Gucci leather bags and being in her company. As they walked toward the chief, Lelia slipped her arm around Tom's.
You know, I've never been on a train before. And for the holidays, too. It's kind of nice. Do they have massage services on board and perhaps a beauty parlor like they do on cruise ships?
That would be a no. They do have a checkerboard in each sleeper unit, but you have to bring your own checkers. Oh, and they do have lots and lots of liquor. Let me tell you, right now, that's a wonderful thing.
Well, maybe you can give me one. A massage, I mean. Oh, I brought the naughty teddy,
she added coyly, leaning up against him. As they were boarding, Tom saw Eleanor out of the corner of his eye. She was watching them both closely, and for one of the few times in his life, he felt totally and completely helpless. They stepped on the chief, said goodbye to Missouri, and the train slid into the flat farmland of Kansas as the darkness deepened. Lelia sat up in her sleeper compartment, but not without some complaints as to its lack of spaciousness and queries as to whether there were any rental units with mahogany paneling and possibly access to a private valet. A hopelessly smitten Barry, the sleeping car attendant, flexed his neck muscles and puffed out his chest and did a few arm curls with her luggage while regaling the woman with train factoids. However, Lelia remained unimpressed and suitably aloof. She did intimate that if he could somehow scrounge up a proper tea service and provide all meals in her room, she might favor him with a smile now and then and also perhaps show him some calf and the flash of a well-defined thigh. And so off Barry went, determined to accomplish all that she had asked. Tom came by her compartment after she'd settled in.
I like what you've done with the place, he said, smiling.
Where are you staying?
In the poor person's sleeper down the road a piece.
Well, you can sleep in here tonight.
He sat down on the edge of the turned-down bed.
Look, I have something to tell you. I didn't think it would be like this. I mean, on the train and all. But I might as well tell you now.
She put her hand over his.
I think I know what you're going to say. That's the reason I flew all this way.
It is. How could she have known about Eleanor? Why are you here? He asked.
After what happened with Eric, I was furious with you. I really was. But it was nice, too. I mean, you're being jealous and all.
Thanks. I'm glad I could do that for you.
Well, I started to think things through. We've been together a while now, and decisions have to be made.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And I made my decision. And I didn't want to tell you over the phone. And I couldn't wait until Christmas, because this might change our plans for the holidays.
Tom sighed in relief.
I really think we're on the same page here.
She leaned forward and put both hands on his shoulders.
Tom, I want to get married.
All he could say was,
To who?
To you, silly. And I think it's to whom, but you're the writer.
You want to marry me? You flew all this way to tell me you want to get married to me?
He rose in his agitation and paced in his anxiety. And the result was that Tom banged his head against the large window like a bird desperately trying to escape confinement.
Lelia, this is a long way from seeing each other a few times a year for fun and games. This is for a lifetime, and every day, good times and bad.
Don't you think I know that?
He pointed at her. Is this some new class you're taking? Some new age psychedelic voodoo parapsychology crap? She stood up.
No, this is about me. I'm not getting any younger. My biological clock isn't just ticking. Its alarm is ringing, and I've hit the snooze button so many times it doesn't work anymore.
You're saying you want to have children?
Yes, don't you?
You're asking me if I want children?
Are you deaf? Yes.
How do I know if I want kids? I didn't know you were going to come and propose tonight. Let a guy catch his breath, will you?
She put her arms around him.
I know it's all of a sudden, But we're good together, Tom, really good. I've got plenty of money, and we can do whatever we want. We'll travel, play, enjoy good times, and then settle down and have a huge family.
Huge? Huge family? How huge?
Well, I'm one of eight.
He looked at her petite frame.
You work out 6 hours a day. Are you saying you're going to let your body bloat up 8 times? Even if we space it out a kid every 2 years, you'll be 60 by the time the last bundle of joy pops out, Lelia.
Well, I thought we'd have one the regular way and adopt the rest, you know, all at once. Sort of an instant family.
He put a hand through his hair with an impulse to tear most of it out.
I can't believe this.
What, did you think we were just going to do our little bi-coastal thing until one of us died? That was not a relationship of permanence, Tom.
Agreed, it wasn't permanent.
I know this is a lot to throw at you. Take your time and think about it. It's 2 days to L.A. Just think about it, and then let me know.
In 2 days? You want me to let you know if I want to get married and have 8 kids in 2 days?
Well, depending on your answer, we'll have a lot to do. So, yes, promptness would be appreciated.
She kissed him on the cheek and took his hands in hers.
Now, what were you going to tell me?
He just stared at her, open mouth, unable to speak, since no words were strong enough to survive the acid eating through his throat. They just melted like snow on a griddle. He turned to leave.
Where are you going?
He found his voice.
To the bar.
When will you be back?
2 days.
Chapter 24. As Tom staggered to the lounge car to find support at the bottom of as many tequila shots as he could fire into his body, the chief hurtled on to Lawrence, Kansas, primarily known as the home of the University of Kansas. They'd reached that stop at about 1:30 in the morning, followed by Topeka at 2, and thereafter in fairly quick succession, Newton, Hutchinson, Dodge City, and Garden City, their last stop in Kansas before entering Colorado. La Junta, the site of the marriage, was the second stop in Colorado, and about 2 hours before the chief began its assault on the Raton Pass. The storm was now fully formed, and, driven by fierce upper-level winds, was plowing south, knocking against the immovable frame of the Rocky Mountains. So far, the winter in the area had seen above-normal snowfall, and the mountaintops were heavily wreathed in white. The winds kicked some of the fallen snow around, but no serious damage was reported, and while forecasters had their eye on the moving mass of swirling wind and moisture, they had no reason to believe that it was any different from countless storms that had come before it. The chief would have to ascend toward the Raton Pass, navigate the half-mile-long tunnel that ran under the pass, and then descend into the station stop at Raton. As soon as the train exited the tunnel, it would leave Colorado and enter New Mexico. There'd also been considerable snowfall here, and the mountaintops were caked with many feet of hardened snow that normally wouldn't leave until summer, and even then some of the highest peaks would retain their white beard pretty much all year round. It would take a lot to dislodge all those millions of tons of snow. Eleanor wandered through the train, trying to stop from dissolving into tears. She looked in on Father Kelly, who was sitting in his compartment, fully dressed and reading his Bible. He invited her in, and she sat down next to him. "Can't sleep?" she asked. "Well, Max is hosting a bachelor's party for Steve, and I'm resting up for that. You know, when I had my parish, I worked 16 hours a day and slept hard for 8 hours at night, my mind free from worry because of him, and because I'd done my best during the day. And now that I'm out of the service, so to speak, I don't work nearly as hard, and I don't seem to require nearly as much sleep. And the train is a soothing place to read and reflect. I spent all my time and consideration on my parishioners' trouble for all those years, and I guess I didn't reflect enough on my own. Pretty late in life to arrive at that conclusion, isn't it?"
"Better late than never," she said.
He said diplomatically, "I saw Tom with that lady. They seem to know each other very well."
"I guess they should. They're sort of a couple somehow."
"Oh, I see." She looked at the Bible in his lap. Any advice in there for a broken heart?
There's help in here for anything that ails you, Eleanor.
I go to Mass regularly, but I haven't studied the Scriptures as much as I should have. Maybe I should do something about that.
He smiled. Well, better late than never. I'll be talking to him later, and I'll be sure to say a blessing for you. I'll even make it a double.
I really appreciate that, Father.
They say that during the week of Christmas, any miracle is possible. Of course, as a priest, I believe that miracles are always possible. But it does seem that around the birth date of Jesus, there's a more positive energy out there.
That's a nice thought, she said unconvincingly.
Things might look bad now, but in matters of the heart, you'd be surprised how quickly things can change.
Actually, that's what I'm afraid of.
Where there's faith, there's no fear.
She smiled weakly.
What part of the Bible is that from?
He patted her hand.
That one, my dear, is from Father Paul Joseph Kelly, and you can have it at no extra charge.
Roxanne walked through the lounge car, doing a last check on things, and saw Harry Kiggins still sitting there staring out the window. She sat next to him.
Why don't you get to bed, Herrick? I have a spare bunk in the transition car I fixed up for you.
Thank you, Roxanne. I'll get to bed shortly.
She followed his gaze out the window at the plunging snow.
I put extra food on at KC just in case.
You're a wise woman. One can never be too careful. You get nervous on me after all these years, Mr. Higgins.
He shrugged and smiled.
Maybe I'm inventing worries just so I can feel useful again.
She put a hand on his shoulder.
They should never have let you go. When we all heard about it, that was a consensus up and down the line. Some folks work these trains. They don't care, just drawing down a paycheck. But you're not like that. People like you put the soul in these big hunks of steel.
And people like you, Roxanne.
As the chief rolled on, she said,
I've been doing this a lot of years. I wonder when it's time to make the last train stop and call it a show.
When and if you do, do it on your terms, Roxanne, not anyone else's.
Well, there might not even be trains 10 years from now. What happens then?
He smiled.
Then we tell our grandchildren how wonderful they were to ride.
Tom was intercepted by Max and Misty before he could reach the lounge car.
I need a drink, he told Max. I need a drink so unbelievably bad, if I don't get one, I'm not responsible for my actions.
Max said, I've got every drink you can think of, plus a case of chilled wine in my compartment.
Let's start the bachelor's party right now. And I decided why limit it to the guys, so I invited the girls too.
Actually, said Misty, I think that was my idea.
How'd you manage all the booze?
He's Max Powers, said Misty.
I just phoned ahead to Kansas City and said, charge it. This isn't exactly rocket science, kids.
I love it when he calls me a kid, said Misty. Makes me feel so young.
We have a wedding tomorrow, and you and Eleanor and the others are playing pivotal roles. So along with the party, we have to rehearse, too.
I don't think that's such a good idea right now, Max, said Tom.
Don't be silly. Take it from me. I know what I'm talking about. I do this for a living. You have to rehearse or else you'll screw up. We owe it to Steve and Julie to put on a good show. Now, come on, kiddies. Uncle Max always gets his way.
The man literally skipped down the corridor, obviously enjoying himself immensely. Misty followed, and that left Tom to trudge miserably after the impish pair. Max sent Cristobal out to round up Steve, Julie, Eleanor, Roxanne, and the minister who'd be conducting the service. The latter was tall and trim, with short gray hair, a wise look, and kindly eyes, the perfect image of a man of the cloth. Tom actually would have preferred Father Kelly, who was also in attendance. The priest tried to chat with his colleague, but the minister was quite standoffish, and Father Kelly finally gave up. Max's compartment consisted of two rooms arranged as a suite. Tom looked around at the spaciousness.
How'd he manage this?
He's Max Powers, said Misty.
The director took center stage and passed out pieces of paper stapled together.
Okay, here's the script for tomorrow, including each scene, I mean each part of the wedding.
Tom slid over to Cristobal, who was manning the bar that had been set up in one corner.
Got any scotch, he said.
I'm afraid all we have is 25-year-old single malt Macallan's. It's Mr. Power's personal favorite.
Tom stared at him.
Well, I guess that'll just have to do, won't it?
I spent all afternoon typing out those scripts, said Cristobal.
Max, of course, had a million changes. He always does. The man is brilliant, I have to give him that.
Tom sipped his scotch and looked over at Eleanor, who it seemed to him was trying mightily not to make eye contact with anyone, particularly him. And who could blame her? She was studiously going over the script while Max barked directions to everyone. Tom had just worked up the courage to go over to her when Lelia flounced in and sidled up to him.
I understand there's a bachelor's party going on that my Mr. Langdon failed to tell me about.
Then Lelia's gaze fell upon Max Powers. Tom noted that as soon as the director saw Lelia, he tried to hide behind Misty.
Max? Max Powers? Said Lelia. My God, it is you!
Lelia fussed at her hair and tugged at her dress, though both were immaculate. Max turned back, acted surprised, and then said,
Lelia, is that really you?
Tom said, You know each other?
Oh, it was years ago, said Max quietly.
But it feels like yesterday, Max, said Lelia. I auditioned for one of his films, a minor role. It was years ago, but he was already a legend,
she added in an awestruck tone.
Now, Lelia, said Max nervously, my ego is big enough without your adding to it.
She didn't appear to hear him.
I didn't get the role. You remember the film, Max?
No, sweetie, I really don't. I've lost so many brain cells since then.
It was fall of summer, about a young couple falling in and out of love during a summer holiday.
Right, of course.
I never really knew why I didn't get the part of the girl's best friend, Bambi Moore.
Obviously, one of my biggest mistakes, Lelia. I made lots of them early on in my career.
Well, you had the decency to take me to dinner one night. Do you remember that?
Of course, dinner. It was lovely.
And dinner stretched to breakfast. I trust you remember that part of the audition.
Lelia hiked her eyebrows and puckered her lips.
Let's break out the booze, shouted Max, and get this rehearsal really rolling.
Max's considerable skill as a director and obsession over the smallest detail were felt by all that night. Again and again he put them through their paces. Finally, Tom called for a break over Max's protests, which were quickly shouted down by all hands. Lelia walked over to Eleanor while Tom looked on in horror at this imminent clash.
I understand you're the maid of honor, and Tom is the best man. How fun and convenient for you.
You really think so? Said Eleanor.
Those weren't the adjectives jumping to my mind. Tom and I are going to Tahoe for Christmas. You went from L.A. to Kansas City and got on a train headed back to L.A. so you can go to Tahoe for Christmas? That's quite a circuitous route to take. Well, I had something very important to ask Tom.
Oh, what was that?
To marry me.
Eleanor looked over at Tom furiously. And then Lelia said,
Somebody told me you and Tom once dated. You don't have hepatitis, do you?
She added with an impish grin at Tom.
Excuse me?
Said Eleanor.
You know, it's funny, Eleanor. It is Eleanor, isn't it? Well, it's funny. Tom never once mentioned your name. I guess it wasn't a very memorable relationship.
Sure he mentioned my name, said Eleanor.
Probably when you two were in bed together.
Lelia's mouth dropped so far, Tom could see the woman still had her tonsils.
So, how's everyone doing on drinks? Was all he could think to say.
With one more fierce glance at him, Eleanor said to Lelia,
Don't worry, honey. You can have him.
As Eleanor stormed out, Tom raced over, but Lelia grabbed him.
Did you hear what she said to me?
Tom stopped and watched as Eleanor disappeared down the hall.
Tom, did you hear me?
He finally looked at her.
Lelia?
What?
Shut up.
Lelia seemed poised to erupt at him, but she simply spun around on her heels and left. As Tom's world was collapsing, Roxanne stood up and said to Max,
Okay, baby, let's cut to the chase.
She held up her script pages.
This stuff is okay, but I'm going to need some wiggle room to improvise.
Wiggle room? Improvise? Said Max nervously.
Yeah, you know, do some things on the fly, play off the energy of the crowd.
But it's a wedding, Roxanne, and preparation is the key to any successful project like this. I've got all the songs I want you to sing listed and in due sequence.
Steve and Julie just looked anxiously at the pair as they squared off.
I'll be prepared, but you can't cage the wild bird, Max. You gotta let the wild bird fly when it wants to, or else it dies.
But,
she put a hand on Max's shoulder.
Look here, baby. You trust me, don't you? Well, sure, but then that's all I need to know.
She turned to Steve and Julie and patted their hands.
Now you two get a good night's sleep. This train'll be rocking tomorrow in your honor. I promise you one thing. You're never going to forget Roxanne Jordan and the Southwest Chief.
As people started to trickle away, Tom stood there so forlornly that Max finally came over to him. You look like you could use another drink. Max mixed two cocktails and the men sat down.
So that Roxanne is great, isn't she?
Yeah, great, said Tom distractedly. Max slapped Tom on the thigh.
Sorry there wasn't a girl popping out of a cake at the bachelor party. I didn't think it would be appropriate with the ladies present, and, to tell you the truth, Amtrak probably would have balked at that one.
Tom finally focused on the director.
So you, what, dated Lelia? Well, I wouldn't call it dating, actually. It was just the one time, as far as I can remember. My memory is not what it was. Hey, did I hear right? Lelia asked you to marry her?
Tom nodded.
Man, I guess women do that these days. So does that mean if you divorce, she has to pay you alimony?
She won't have to pay me anything because we're not getting married.
Look, Tom, I'm not trying to butt in or anything, but Lelia is beautiful. And doesn't she do some cartoon thing that brings her big bucks?
Cuppy the Magic Beaver, Freddy the Futon, Petey the Pickle.
Right, Cuppy, Petey, that's good stuff. I think one of my ex-wife's step-grandkids used to watch it. Anyway, okay, she's beautiful, she's got bucks, and she asked you to marry her. So don't rush your decision, you might not get another chance. No offense, you're a good-looking guy and I like you, but you're not exactly a spring chicken anymore either.
You're right, she's rich, she's beautiful, and I don't love her, Max. Max sat back against his seat and let out a long sigh. I've done the deed 4 times now. Who knows, maybe there's a 5th in the works for me. And you love them all? The director leaned forward, and his expression grew somber.
Patty was my first wife, married right out of high school. I joined the Army, then moved to California. We had 4 kids. We were dirt poor, but she never complained, not once. She could stretch a buck farther than anyone I've ever met. I broke into the movie business. I was just starting to make it when she died.
Max grew quiet, looked out the window at the passing countryside.
Yeah, I loved Patty with everything I had. I'll always love Patty.
My 3 ex-wives? He shrugged.
I married them, had some good times, divorced them, and that was it. I loved them in a way, but not like Patty. If she'd lived, I'd never have even looked at another woman. I guess there's something special about your first love. Now I just play the field and I have fun, but I'm not all that proud of it. None of it's permanent, you know?
Tom nodded. I know.
Max looked at Tom. You ever been married?
Tom nodded again.
Did you love her?
Let's put it this way. She was no Patty. Max drew closer to Tom and said in a low voice,
Again, I'm not trying to butt in, but can you answer a question for me?
I guess.
Why aren't you and Eleanor together?
You saw what happened. She just stormed out of here.
Well, you can't blame her, really. Your girlfriend flies in from L.A. to propose. Now, God knows, I'm no expert in affairs of the heart, but that's not exactly the ideal way to win back the love of your life.
I've tried, Max. I've really tried.
Well, you know what?
Tom looked at him.
What? If she's really your Patty, I'd try harder.
Chapter 25 Eleanor was back in her compartment, about to swallow a sleeping pill of enormous diameter, when someone knocked on her door.
"Go away!" she yelled.
"Eleanor, it's me."
She looked blank for a moment, trying to identify the voice through the dulled filters of her very overwrought mind.
"Julie?"
She went to the door and opened it. and there stood the young bride-to-be, tears in her eyes. She was holding a long garment bag.
"What's the matter? Steve's parents didn't call again, did they?"
Julie shook her head.
"And neither did mine."
Eleanor looked confused.
"I'm not sure I understand. Can I come in for a few minutes?"
"What? Sure." Eleanor slipped the knockout pill in her pocket.
"But it's late and you have a big day tomorrow. You need to get some rest."
The two women sat on the edge of the bed.
"So your parents didn't call and you're sad because..."
she coaxed.
"Well, I suppose a girl envisions her parents being at her wedding. I mean, most brides I've known have been control freaks about their wedding, and it's not like I feel helpless or anything, but still you imagine your father giving his little girl away, and your mom telling you everything's going to be okay. And, well, I don't have any of that."
She suddenly burst into tears and sobbed for some time while Eleanor held her tightly. When she finally stopped, Julie wiped her eyes and looked embarrassed.
"I'm sorry. I'm a grown woman and I should be able to handle this, but I just feel so alone."
Eleanor brought her a damp washcloth to wipe her face.
"You have every right to feel that way, and I guess I've been a pretty lousy maid of honor." "Well, you were recruited at the last minute. You don't even really know me."
"It shouldn't matter. We're both women. You're going to be a bride tomorrow. That's all I should need to know."
"Have you ever been married?"
"No," said Eleanor quietly. "But I've thought about it a lot. Imagined every detail of it, down to the finger foods and flower displays. I don't dream about it as much as I used to, though."
"Why not?"
"It's a simple matter of time. Years go by, the chances of it happening steadily diminish."
"Well, all you need is someone who loves you, and you love him back."
Eleanor smiled when she actually felt like bawling harder than Julie just had.
"Yep, that's all you need."
She touched the garment bag Julie had set on the bed.
"What's this?"
Julie looked embarrassed again.
"It's my wedding gown. I haven't tried it on since I bought it. I thought maybe, you know."
"What a wonderful idea," said Eleanor.
"You sure you don't mind? Like you said, it's late and I'm sure you're tired."
"Actually, I was tired, but now I'm not." Eleanor helped Julie into her dress, a simple yet elegant outfit of cream white that fit perfectly. As she was about to place the veil on Julie's head, Julie took it and put it on Eleanor. The two women stood side by side in front of the full-length mirror.
"You look beautiful, Julie." "So do you."
Julie started laughing hysterically, and Eleanor finally joined her. Later, as Eleanor was about to pack up the gown and Julie was in the bathroom, Eleanor put the veil back on and held the gown up to her and looked in the mirror.
"Ellie?"
She looked over where the door to her compartment had slid open with the curves of the track and the acceleration of the chief. It was Tom, staring at her. Her arms couldn't move. She just stood there, mutely covered by another woman's wedding dress.
"Ellie,"
he said again as he stepped through the door. At that moment, Julie came out of the bathroom and looked at each of them.
"Sorry if I interrupted something," she said.
Eleanor lowered the gown, took the veil, and carefully packed it all away while Tom watched. She handed the garment back to Julie, gave her a hug, and said with a smile,
"Sleep hard. Your whole life changes tomorrow morning, for the better."
Julie kissed her on the cheek, turned, and walked past Tom, who still stood there, looking as awkward as he did confused.
"What do you want, Tom?"
"You looked really beautiful in that dress, Ellie."
"It's late. Shouldn't you be with Lelia?"
"I don't love Lelia."
"Well, she seems to love you. I assume you must have shown some affection or made some comment or promise to her, because I find it hard to believe the woman would have flown all this way to ask you to marry her out of friendship or kindness. Frankly, she doesn't strike me as the type."
"I'm telling you, our relationship was not like that."
"Really? So what was it like to make her come all this way?"
She folded her arms across her chest and waited expectantly.
"How do I know why she'd do something like that? She's nuts!"
"You've been seeing each other how long?"
Tom sputtered.
"About 3 years, but off and on."
"Off and on? 3 years?"
"Yes."
"And you expected her to be content with that?"
He just looked at her blankly. Eleanor continued.
So she wanted to make a commitment, but you didn't. You were perfectly happy with popping in, popping out, sharing the good times, not the bad, and going your solo way when you felt like it.
It's not like that, Ellie. I'm not like that anymore.
Sure you're not. You haven't changed, not a bit. It would be different with the right woman.
Eleanor rubbed her temples.
Listen, we have a wedding to do tomorrow, someone else's wedding. I need some sleep.
We can't leave it like this.
Oh, yes, we can. And we are.
He moved to take her in his arms, but she firmly pushed him away.
We'll do our duty tomorrow. We'll get to L.A., and we'll go our separate ways, this time for good.
Ellie!
Goodbye, Tom.
She slid the door closed with finality. Chapter 26. The dawn broke over the high plains of Colorado near the New Mexico border, but the sun was completely hidden by a vast sky of threatening clouds. The snow lay thickly over the ground, covering the ubiquitous sagebrush. Most folks assembled for an early breakfast because word had spread rapidly about the upcoming nuptials. As the train neared La Junta, the excitement grew and virtually all the passengers and crew crowded into the lounge car, such that there was barely enough room for the wedding procession, which consisted of the bride and groom and a maid of honor and best man who never once looked at each other. Even though they walked in together arm in arm, it was as though an invisible force separated them. The wedding went off without any major glitches. A group of musicians Max had hired and who'd gotten on early that morning played the traditional wedding march and other tunes. Cristobal filmed the entire event, and Max directed as best he could, with most people on the train not even knowing this was a Max Powers production of sorts. Tom and Eleanor did their respective parts, though Tom, for one awkward moment, couldn't find the ring, and then for one even much more awkward moment, seemed to be trying to place it on Eleanor's finger instead of handing it to Steve. Then that was all straightened out, and Tom was able to step back and quietly ponder various suicide opportunities that might come his way. The bride and groom kissed right as the train stopped at La Junta, and Julie raised her fist in the air and shouted,
"Yes!"
Normally, Pike's Peak would be clearly visible at the stop, but not even that towering chunk of rock could be seen through the cloud cover. All throughout the ceremony, Herrick Higgins had sat quietly in his corner and watched the vicious-looking sky. Everyone on board threw rice, and outside the window, a group of mostly trained personnel from the station did the same, the white kernels disappearing rapidly in the swirling snow. At La Junta, the chief also attached the third diesel engine to help it over the pass. As the train pulled out of the station, the crowd lining the track roared in appreciation at the "Just Married" sign that had been hung on the last car of the chief and the strung tin cans rattling just below the sign. It was an enviable beginning to any marriage. Then the party on the train really started, highlighted by the enormous feast Max had also paid for. As people stuffed themselves and the official wedding photographer took photos, Roxanne came sweeping out in a flamboyant costume that was definitely not Amtrak standard issue. She was trailed by the L.A. Boys Center choir, also dressed in their finest. The crowd grew quiet, the musicians stood ready, and Roxanne and the choir began to sing. It was all a vast yet delicate thing of beauty. They sang classical songs, then the blues, then some hip-hop, and next a string of tunes from Nat King Cole to Sinatra. She followed that up by belting out Chain of Love, doing her best Aretha Franklin impersonation, and next the Queen of Soul's signature piece, Respect. The crowd was so into it by this time that people were standing and shouting out each letter with her. The woman's voice was booming, and she was swirling around the floor in intricate dance steps with a grace and litheness that belied her great size. Sweat was streaming down her face and neck, and she seemed truly possessed by something heavenly as she shouted out a series of amens. Max could only sit back and smile. He ceremoniously tore up his script when Roxanne looked over at him, and then she pulled him up with her and they danced together, at which point everyone else joined in. While the Capital Limited had probably seen such strutting before, this was probably a first for the Southwest chief. Lelia pulled Tom over, but he managed to promptly pull himself away, citing nausea, which wasn't altogether a falsehood. It had truly been a rough night for him, much of which had been spent in the communal bathroom giving back most of the alcohol he'd drank. Poor, deserted Lelia looked around and spotted Cristobal, who was packing away the video equipment.
"Care to dance?"
she asked the handsome young man. Cristobal looked up and his eyes perceptibly widened at her glamorous figure and attire.
"You work for Mr. Powers, don't you?"
Cristobal nodded.
"I'm Lelia Gibson."
His eyes widened further and he blurted out,
"Lelia Gibson, the voice of Cuppy the Magic Beaver?"
She was taken aback.
"Why, yes. You know the show?"
"Know the show? It was my favorite when I was a kid. My little brother still watches it. And all my nieces and nephews, it's their number one program. You're terrific. I saw you at Mr. Power's party last night, but I never heard your name. And I only knew you, well, by voice."
Lelia looked flustered.
"You watched it as a child? My, I have been doing the show a long time, haven't I?"
Cristobal dropped all pretense of self-restraint or professional dignity, so overwhelmed was he.
"And Sassy Squirrel and Freddy the Futon and Petey the Orange Pickle, they're all classics. I cried during the episode when Petey was caught in the storm drain and all his color was washed out. The depth of emotion you gave him during that tragic scene, it took me weeks to get over it. Look, I don't mean to gush, but I just can't believe you're on this train. Would it be asking too much for your autograph? My family is just not going to believe this. My little brother is going to freak."
"Why, certainly you can have my autograph.
Oh, where are my manners? I'm Cristobal Goldman."
He gave her hand an enthusiastic shake that almost lifted petite Lelia right out of her outrageously expensive open-toed 3-inch heels.
"I tell you what, Cristobal, I'll autograph anything you want if you'll dance with me."
An astonished Cristobal bowed deeply and off they went. While everyone was preoccupied at the wedding and party afterward, about 20 more compartments were robbed of various items, from watches and rings to bracelets and even Max's pair of Bruno Mali's. Once more, the thief made a clean getaway, although there was someone lurking in the corridor who might have seen something suspicious. Yet no alarm was given, and the thief quickly melded back into the partygoers. The bag of loot was bulging more than ever, and they still had a day remaining before their scheduled arrival into L.A. During the night, the storm had settled over the border between Colorado and New Mexico. Virtually locked in place by a high-pressure system, the clouds were now so heavy with moisture that something had to give. And it did. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, with the chief still over 8 hours away, the gauges used to measure snowfall were filled within an hour. The enormous